I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Rio Olympics are over, but there are some leftover issues, including the hurtful and hateful comments that gold medal gymnasts Simone Biles and Gabby Douglas got about their hair on social media. At the 2012 Olympics, Douglas was criticized for her ponytail. This year, it was her edges. And this is not new. African-American girls and women have always had to contend with judgments about their hair. And that's what we're going to explore today on Radio Times. And we have three guests who have joined us, two of whom are here in our Philadelphia studio. Elizabeth Wellington is fashion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, wrote about all of this earlier this week. And Elizabeth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi.
Also with us is Sarita Scott, CEO of Duafe Holistic Hair Care Salon here in Philadelphia. Sarita, nice to have you with us as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. And joining us by telephone is Lori Tharps, and she's Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University. Wrote a book a number of years ago called Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. And Lori, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Do we have Lori? We will get Lori. I can hear noises, but I can't hear Lori yet. Elizabeth, you wrote about this earlier this week, both talking about yourself and also talking about the fact that we've got gold medal gymnasts, you know, just showing us their stuff in Rio. But what happens on social media? People talking about their hair.
Yes, it's really unfortunate because I think that these women had to go through so much to get to where they are. And that's so much practice that goes into that. And to see people just talk about how they look as a result of all the hard work that they're doing, it's really painful. And I think it really would stop, you know, it has the power and the potential to stop other young women who really are interested in exercise. But when you're young, you crave the support and the applause of people, especially people of your own race and your own family and own women in your own networks. And to hear them say that, it's definitely could be discouraging.
I mean, a lot of this was social media. And as we know, social media is where trolls live. It's where a lot of people can be hateful, hurtful, and anonymous. Is that what we're talking about largely?
I think it's something that happens within the African-American community. Yeah. But now that we have social media, sometimes we forget that when we're on social media, the entire world can see what we're saying. So things that you think, I mean, I think this is something that has been, if you're an African-American woman living in this country for any amount of time, you've heard a lot of this criticism or these things all of your life. So, but now social media sort of opens that. So you're tweeting, and I think people are in their living room thinking that they're talking to the person next to them.
Right.
But it's going out viral, and I think that's what happens.
Are we talking largely about black women criticizing other black women?
In the case of this particular instance, it was largely black women criticizing other black women. But that does not mean that the internet, that people of other races do not criticize black women for the way they look. But I think that the kitchen or the edges is something that a lot that's not really familiar with the white world at large. So the terms that were used were terms that African-American right. people are very familiar with. And it doesn't that's not something that's largely known.
I got you. Which is in part why we want to do the show. I'm curious, Sarita, about your observations. I mean, you know hair in many ways like nobody else here.
Yes, at a
when
deep
you
level.
Read, I mean, we're talking about Simone Manuels, Simone Biles, Gabby Douglas. I mean, there are other people I can name as well.
Well, you know, it's really sad because I own a natural hair salon, and it takes people a lot of courage to be able to make that choice to choose not to wear their hair straight and opt to wear their hair natural. That courage is something that people, a lot of people feel extremely uncomfortable about because their concept of beauty looks more like it's more straight, it's more kept, as people will want to say. I don't agree with the kept word. It's more laid back. So when people see themselves naturally, it forces them to think about beauty in a deeper level. And that's what we're dealing with this whole situation with the Olympics. As Elizabeth said, these young ladies have took the time to hone in on their craft, the time, the effort, the blood, the sweat, the tears, and the moment when they're seen or they're performing,
they're standing on,
and they're in the lights, you find something to pick at them about. So what's happening is you're seeing a sandbox in the most adult form where you can't
find beauty. Like the schoolyard, you mean?
Right, the schoolyard, where you can't find beauty in yourself, so I'm going to pick at someone else.
There's this thing about edges. I'm yes. a white girl, so help us understand okay. about edges.
So edges. Edges is when your true self, your natural self, is now revealed. It's when it's the obvious that your hair, you were not born with straight hair. It is you have not taken out the time to alter you enough so you fit in. So when you talk about edges, you're talking about tight curls, what some people will call kinky. You're talking about natural hair, which isn't straight. You're talking about a curve, a wave that they feel needs to be hidden at all times.
And this is on the sort of where the
hairline begins and the straight hair end.
I got. I mean, it's a tiny little
it's
piece of real estate.
Tiny. That's right. Exactly what it is. What it is just their natural hair that is not altered, that is not straight. So how can you hide that?
Right. Well, and here you are also as a gymnast or a swimmer or whatever. Go ahead, Elizabeth, then we'll get Lori Tharps on the...
I think we also have to explain that. So if you have a relaxer in your hair, it straightens your hair. And so right. people forget that African-American women, the hair that you see, if you see Beyonce's hair on...
That's not how she was
that's
born.
Not her, that's not how she was born. So your hair grows. Like your nails grow, your toenail, everything grows. So you get a relaxer in 6 to 8, less than that, 3 to 4 weeks.
Well, really, here's the thing. It's really supposed to be 6 to 8 weeks. And unfortunately, people are so scared about seeing their edges. They have then brought it to 3 weeks or there is no way to hide what grows right. out of your hair. So and when we're talking about being in Rio in the humidity and we're talking about being a gymnast or an athlete, which you're sweating, your hair will revert back. So they're teasing, and this is where, you know, it's a constant scar that is just being picked. You're teasing someone about who they are,
right.
that's something that they can't change, something that they were born with. So that's when we said edges is the kink, is the curl that is not permed or straightened.
And the one that's just barely growing out of your scalp, right?
Yes,
that's what we're
just
talking
barely.
About. Let me get Lori Tharps in on the conversation again. She's associate professor of journalism at Temple University, author of a book, Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. And Lori, hopefully we have you, and welcome back to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. Olive, I just wanted to say, when you said, you know, how do you explain the edges to a white audience or for someone who's not exactly sure what we're talking about, I think the parallel would be if a white woman has dyed her hair blonde, for example, and then you say your roots are showing, and that, you know, when you forgot, but maybe your dark hair is coming in and everybody can see that you're not a natural blonde. And in a lot of ways, it can just be a throwaway comment like, oh, your roots are showing, but it also kind of has a hidden meaning that you're not passing, you're not fooling anyone. You know, we know you're not really a natural blonde, that's, you know, it's fake.
That's actually...
So I think there's a certain element of, that with this idea that your edges are showing. It can be taken literally, like you forgot to get those little kinks that are showing, but it can also take, I think, what Sarita was saying, is it kind of somehow you're not, it has a more deeper meaning of you haven't quite, you know, brought yourself to the professional level. You know, your hair isn't looking as it should be for the public stage.
Lauren, let me ask you the question I was going to begin the show with, only because you were a guest on the show when your book first came out, Hair Story. I think that was 2002. So that's what, 14 years ago. And here we are once again talking about specifically Black women and their hair. Has anything changed in the last 14 years?
Well, a lot has changed in terms of technology, and I mean that in a lot of different ways, in that we had when the book came out, the hardcover of the book actually came out in 2001, the internet hadn't really come onto the scene. We were still looking at the internet existed, of course, but people weren't using it the way they're using now. And in a lot of positive ways, the internet has allowed a black hair community to grow. grow online. And that community has spawned a lot of like online community. It's spawned a lot of online businesses that have made a lot of Black women very wealthy. And it has just given a place for a movement to grow, for conversations to happen that couldn't happen before. You had a lot of Black women very isolated with their choices about their hair. They chose to go natural, for example, and they lived in like Wisconsin or Iowa or someplace in middle America where there wasn't a thriving Black hair or natural hair market. They could still feel connected. But on the same token, I think what Elizabeth was saying before, the idea of social media has also opened up these private conversations to the whole world. So my thought when Gabby Douglas was first attacked in 2012, I thought that that was the media, the mainstream media, jumping on what kind of Black people were talking about on their own and blowing it up into something that made it sound like all of Black America had a problem with Gabby Douglas' hair, when in fact it was some people chattering in the sandbox, I think somebody said, or,
yes,
you know, talking as they would talk amongst themselves, but it's been amplified. So the changes, I think, have been positive in some ways, but social media has also made all of the insecurities and all of the, you know, latent self-hatred and all the other issues that we're dealing with seem to be worse, I think, than they really are. Or let's say they kind of downplay the progress because they simply amplify the negativity, which social media does, I think, in all aspects.
Elizabeth,
you hear a lot of things you never heard before.
Sure.
Doesn't mean it's worse. It just means you're hearing them for the first time in the public space.
And that certainly is the internet in a nutshell. To you, Elizabeth, we're almost up on our first break here, but one of the things that you wrote about in your piece in the Inquirer was about being a kid growing up and the kind of, I guess, what, hair rituals that you went through with your mom?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't, it's interesting because what Lori was talking about is definitely true. You hear, social media does seem to amplify it. I think what made it different this time with Gabby was that I visually saw her upset. Like,
right.
I saw her crying on TV, and I wasn't even going to discuss it this time because I was just over it. I was like, this is ridiculous. This is nuts. But when I saw her crying, I said to myself, well, maybe there's something else. And people were still kind of chatty. Like, I saw it on Facebook. I saw it on Twitter. And I was hearing the comments. And then I felt that I needed to address it. But when I was, my experience as a child was not much different from most, you know, young African-American women growing up. You know, on special occasions, my mom pressed my hair.
Yeah.
Sometimes you would go to the beauty parlor. Like if it was Easter, but most of the time my mom pressed my hair, and it was, you know, you just sort of got it washed and sectioned and pressed. And then it was, please, if it's raining, don't forget to put on your cap. So it was an experience that most African-American women had. And it wasn't a bad experience. It was just a part of our life.
I got you. Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Elizabeth Wellington, Sarita Scott, and Lori Tharps about Black women and hair. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the aesthetics, the history, the politics of Black hair. Our guests are Elizabeth Wellington. She's fashion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has written about this issue. Also with us, Sarita Scott, CEO of Duafe Holistic Hair Care Salon, which is here in Philadelphia. And joining us by telephone, Lori Tharps, associate professor of journalism at Temple University, wrote a book called Hair Story. And we have comments coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Elizabeth, let me just go back to you quickly, but Sarita and Lori, I want to get you back in on the conversation as well. The piece that you wrote for the Inky, Elizabeth, you talk about obviously the rituals of, mm-hmm. of getting your hair, having your mom do your hair when mm-hmm. you were a kid, but also being told don't sweat, don't swim, don't do anything to kind of mess up your hair.
Right. It was kind of understood that once you got your hair done and it was raining outside, you really wanted to stay in, or you carried an umbrella, or you had back in the 80s, there were these rain scarves that you would tie. Oh, and they were so tacky, but you would have to put them on, and they were plastic and tie them on. And it was just sort of understood that you didn't, you know, but then I wanted to be a pretty little girl. I didn't mm-hmm. want to mess up my Shirley Temple curls. I didn't want my braids to squish, you know, to
draw
to
up.
Shrink up. So that was a part of are your life, but you don't. And then when it's time to play sports, you sort of take that into consideration on your own.
What's it going to do to my hair?
You take it into consideration on your own. I mean, I grew up in the 90s. I wanted a salt and pepper bob. You had to have perfect edges and had to be completely relaxed in order to pull that off. So you think, do I want to date and be cute or do I want to run track? I think I'm going with the boys, you know? So there's this sort of subliminal message that you sort of accept as it is. And then when I was sort of in my 20s, I just looked up and I said, I'm just not going to do this anymore. I refuse. I didn't want to spend that kind of money, you know, on keeping my hair up. So then I sort of, you're even still subliminally using the terms like keeping my hair up.
Yeah, yeah,
it's the
exactly.
hair that grows out of my head. So keeping it up, you know, you decide to weigh it. And that's not to say that, you know, for my friends and my sisters and all the people that I love who decide to continue to relax and straighten their hair, if that is the lifestyle that you want to live, then that is completely right. fine. But I sort of found it limiting because I wanted to do so many other things.
You want to weigh in this, Sarita?
Definitely. And I had that same story. When it was a ritual, you knew on Saturday evening, now it's time to get ready for Sunday. So there was the pressing, there was the burning of the ears, there was the so many different really painful things to then straighten my hair. So when I... I'm a little bit older than Elizabeth, but
I got you all beat, so don't worry about it.
So when I got to a certain age, and why, here's Michael Jackson. Oh my God, why is his hair always straight? And okay, well, maybe we're about the same age. So he has a Jerry curl. Okay, this could be my option to wear my hair straight without having to alter it every Saturday. And I snuck and got a Jerry curl. And when I walked in, my mom saw what was natural now curled. She was just so upset with me, and she was mad, and she decided not to get me the activator that was going to keep it curly. And my hair.
Why was she upset? Because, what did you think would happen to you, or you were saying?
There is
or doing?
A rites of passage when it comes to a brown little girl and her hair. At that time. So you had to really wait until you're 17 to then make those strong choices of perms. You wore your hair pressed and curled usually up until you were 15. 16 is when you were like, oh, wow, I can get a perm. So when I took that out my mother's hands, because that was not our choice in our household for me to get a Jerry curl, she was upset because she was not a part of that. I was not able to make choices on how I wore my hair.
But was she afraid that you were making a statement about yourself or people would judge you a certain kind of way because of what you were doing to your hair?
She said no.
She said no.
I said yes.
I got you.
So
okay.
I went against what she wanted. So when finally the activator ran out and I could not keep it moist and my hair then fell out, she just decided to say, come on, let's go to a barbershop. So now I'm at this really interesting stage in my life where I want boys to look at me and I'm walking around with a boy's haircut. And it's natural. So I spent a lot of my time crying during those years because as I'm on the bus, I hear every black negative derogatory name being thrown at me from not just women, not just girls, but also boys and men teasing me about how I looked.
Wow.
So, when finally my hair grew out enough where I was able to, my mom felt sorry for me and got me a perm. I thought that was going to take all the pain away, but it did not because my hair was still natural and I still was trying to create something different. So when I got to 20 and I realized that wearing my hair straight went against my lifestyle because I enjoyed dancing and swimming and exercising and biking and I could not keep it up. I cut it off and I've been natural ever since I was 20. But that even came with my family feeling embarrassed by my choices.
Really?
Because
really?
It wasn't straight. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't girly. And the boys did not look at me. So I dealt with that too.
Lori, let me give you a chance to tell us your hair story to steal the title from your book. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. What about for you growing up?
Well, this is actually, I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and my hair was literally, like the rest of me, very much in an assimilation mode. So my hair was relaxed by the time I was, maybe 10 or 11. And I believe that that was just the way. I didn't have a very large black community. I had a very large family. Every woman in the family had relaxed hair. And, you know, by keeping my hair relaxed, I could, you know, theoretically wear the same hairstyles as all of my white girlfriends and classmates in school, and which basically meant a ponytail. And so it never occurred to me that my hair was anything except something that just needed to conform to kind of the white aesthetic that was around me. But interestingly, to throw this back to the Olympics,
sure.
I was a swimmer. I was a competitive. I was 9 until I was 18, until I finished high school, and I swam every day for 2 hours a day, sometimes 2 practices a day, and with my hair relaxed. And you know, it was very important for me to keep my hair, you know, seemingly like the other white girls on my swim team, because of course I was the only African American on the swim team in the state of Wisconsin. Often I was the only swimmer, you know, in a pool. But it's just really interesting to me, and this is what I think is really interesting as we're hearing different stories, is that people, the black experience with hair, with sports, you know, it really depends on where you grew up and how you grew up and what you were influenced by. Again, because I grew up in a very white space, it never occurred to me not to do sports because of my hair. I was already I was already different in so many, you know, ways that I just did everything that everybody else did, and it took me an extra long amount of time to maintain my hair, but there was no way I wasn't going to, you know, do what everybody else was doing and have the same experiences. And it just took me an extra long time to wash my hair, condition my hair, blow dry my hair, keep my hair relaxed. But it never occurred to me to let it stop me from doing what I wanted to do. And I just wanted to say that that was what's really interesting. I think the difference between the gymnasts in the Olympics and the track stars in the Olympics, these women, if you look at the, you know, the hair stories and the hairstyles on the track,
on the track
during the Olympics, those styles were amazing, mm-hmm. right? I mean, people were talking about the hair almost as much as they mm-hmm. were talking about how fast these women ran. And yet the gymnastics girls were criticized because their hair wasn't looking as fly as the girls on the track team. So it begs the question of, how come track stars can, you know, take the time to do their hair and have it, I mean, literally not a hair was out of place after running, you know, 400, you know, 200, 100-yard dash, and their hair still looks perfect. And I think it has to do with the incredible white space of gymnastics versus the black space of track. I mean, there's so much how much and what you do with your hair often has to do with what kind of space you're growing up in.
Oh, that's interesting.
And what the expectations are.
You know, Laurie, let me just jump in here because I need to reintroduce the three of you. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That's Laurie Tharps, also with us, Sarita Scott, and Elizabeth Wellington. And we are talking about black women and hair. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play a scene from Chris Rock's movie Good Hair. In this scene, he's walking into several beauty supply stores with a large clear bag full of various textures of black hair. He asks the store owners if he can sell what he calls black hair. Let's give it a listen.
See, I was trying to sell. So I had Indian hair and I sold it easy, but the black hair, nobody.
Would you like to buy some black hair? Yeah, we have. I have all sorts of black hair here. Some of this hair is from Cleveland and Cincinnati. This hair is from Detroit.
Well, you might want to take it back.
So this is not good hair?
Uh-uh. Is that off of someone else's?
So this hair was cut off at a Baptist mm-hmm. temple.
Well, I couldn't. It wouldn't be healthy for me to sell that hair here.
What, you think somebody's gonna get like sickle cell or something from wearing black hair?
Oh yes.
The hair is no good.
But it's black hair.
I know.
For black people.
But black people don't wear that no more.
So my nappy hair is not worth anything.
No.
They don't want to look like you know. alpha cut like this.
Okay.
They want to look the style. You know, you right now you're looking at all the men, can see all the style.
They
want to
look sexy.
They want sexy looking.
So this is sexy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody walks around with nappy hair no more.
No more. You see that? How many people they do it? No. You make sure the hair straight, look more natural.
So to you, Sarita, is there such a thing as good hair? You know, we have this part of our conversation.
I don't believe it. I feel like all hair is good. But when we talk about the history of what they say good hair is hair that is biracial, so curly. It's hair that's easy to comb. It's hair that I can put a comb straight through it without any tug or pull. It's hair that's easier to maintain, and that's what they call good hair. So I wasn't one of those people who had it. It was too often I know that I heard people say, you had bad hair. Even with me and being in a hair salon in this day and time and owning a natural hair salon, too often I hear, oh, my hair isn't good. I'm like, what is that? It's just, it is extremely sad. So in my personal belief, there is no such thing as good or bad hair. But there is a large population of people who feel like if I can't comb through it without any tug or pull, it's not good hair.
Where does that come from, Elizabeth? This idea that I don't have good hair, where does that message come from?
Can I jump in there?
You slavery. Can, Laurie. Elizabeth is it thinking. Go ahead, Laurie.
Okay. I mean, the real roots of that term of, you know, of good hair and bad hair, you know, they come from slavery when good hair actually, I mean, these are not beauty terms. These were not terms that were created for, you know, defining who was beautiful and who wasn't. These were really terms that were defining, like, survival techniques. Because, essentially, when a slave had more characteristics that resembled those of the white master, of Europeans, those slaves were often selected for better positions in the hierarchy of the slave system. Excuse me. So, if you had hair that was loose and curled and you had lighter skin, then the slave owners would often choose those slaves to work in the house. They might choose them for more positions that offered more benefits to success, to survival. So that became, I mean, it really became a necessity or a goal to loosen these or straighten the hair by whatever means necessary, and that was for both females and males. So if your hair was good, it got you things, freedom even sometimes, if you were lucky. So these concepts of good and bad hair, you know, really, really came from that time period and manifested and stayed with us until current times. So even when people talk about good hair, they're not necessarily saying, you know, I mean, it's morphed into a beauty term in some ways, but it also has this whole loaded connotation of you're going to get further. You're going to be more successful. You are even smarter. You're a better person. You're worth more with that type of hair.
You may get married.
Interesting. Let me read a tweet from Alexis who says, despite perfect curls, my daughter, age 4, has been asking for long, straight hair since she was the age of 2. And Elizabeth, I guess that's sort of a variation on what I was asking you. Laurie talks about this history here, of course, tied in with slavery. But why do you think this idea of good hair still matters or has some kind of impact today in 2016?
Because we're never that far from what happened historically. And I think that once, you know, when African Americans were emancipated, when we were freed, and we set up our own communities, because of survival, which is what Laurie said, a lot of these rules continued within our own community. Mm. So if you wanted to do well, if you wanted to go to college, if you wanted to join a certain sororities and fraternities at the time, everything was predicated on the way you looked. And so when things become based on how you look, quite naturally a beauty trend is going to come from that. It's not much different from, I don't know, Marilyn Monroe in the 50s with her body, and you know, she had this perfect round idealized body. And, you know, that became a trend because people liked it, or a certain group liked it. And so I think now when we have pop culture, when we have certain ideals of beauty that now become beauty trends, and you're seeing it on television and you're seeing it in magazines and you're seeing, you know, I use the term Beyonce because mm-hmm. now she is, that look is considered the ideal look. It's the look, and that goes back from videos in the 80s and the 90s and, you know, when we were all younger growing up. And so people become somehow, some way, and it's not just the African-American community. It is the larger white community, because when they look at us, those are the people that they point out. Those are the people that they put on the covers of magazines. These, you know, these are the looks that are beloved and cherished. So now you have beauty trends, you have survival, you know, it's quite naturally people then decide that in order, I want these things, I want to be loved. And if that is not how you were born, then people do everything they can to become that. Not just for beauty's sake, but when you start to connect beauty and trends to love and self-worth,
This
is what happened.
I got you.
This is how it happened.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Elizabeth Wellington. She's fashion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio along with Sarita Scott. Sarita is the CEO of Duafe Holistic Hair Care Salon here in Philadelphia. And joining us by telephone, Lori Tharps, associate professor of journalism at Temple University, wrote a book called Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. And that's what we're doing. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. I'll read some more comments as well. We have Kent from Center City, Philadelphia. Kent, go ahead. You're on the air.
Great show. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to give you the perspective. I'm a 51-year-old black man. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and I read a book called Raising Black Girls by Jawaza Kanjufu. There's some pearls of wisdom in there. One, black hair grows out, not down. And I think we need to own that. He really delves into the fact that perms and relaxers have lye. It burns the scalp. There's many black women going bald by their mid-40s because they've had decades of these perms. He equates the large percentage of black women who cannot swim to those not wanting that chemical reaction in their hair and their hair falling out in the pool, as well as the large percentage of overweight and obese black women coming from not wanting to sweat out their permed or relaxed hair. And to close, I would say Chaka Khan and Pam Grier had the market in the early 70s cornered on sexy. And they had big natural
yes,
hair.
They did, Kent. I appreciate the call. You put out a bunch of stuff here. Let me just give Sarita Scott a chance to weigh in on that. What do you think, Sarita?
Well, I'm in total agreeance. You know, the challenge is these daughters, because I have one too. They look at TV. They're looking at the magazines with you. So, you know, very early, you have to take control of your environment and culture in your home to help them, guide them as to this is what this person chose, but how you're so beautiful, I care about you. Have to affirm our girls, or they will stare and try to find their definition of beauty elsewhere. It's not a easy thing, and this is not a conversation that is going to heal all wounds in an hour. This is something that has to be a constant muscle that needs to be strengthened to affirm our women, no matter how they wear their hair. You know, what more can we say?
Well, and I have to say, during the break, Elizabeth Wellington was saying one of the things about women and hair, especially black women and hair, is the kind of bonding that takes place, whether it was mother, daughter, or between women, the kind of relationship, I guess, it develops.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'll say, you know, my mom was one of those people that was really not, she didn't talk about race, complexion, and good hair and bad hair and all these other things. But you know, when she did, a lot of times when she did my hair, we talked about beauty. We talked about things that, that mattered to me, things that I was worried about. I was worried about two things, my hair and the size of my thighs. You know, and I was always worried about how I looked and how it came across. And it wasn't because I was getting negative reinforcement at home. The reinforcement at home was positive. It was going out into the world and dealing with, you know, these mean girls. And thank God there was no Facebook and Twitter when I was in high school.
I would have been, it can be brutal.
It would have been horrible. But, you know, I was getting these messages that I wasn't pretty or that I wasn't, you know, beautiful. And it wasn't from where I was at home. It was, you know, part of getting my hair done was just a part of grooming. It was like brushing my teeth. It was, you know, what you did. So I think it's really, really hard because we internalize so much, especially as young girls and as young girls growing up. And a lot of times Black women get a bad rep, you know, for not smiling enough or not being pleasant enough or rolling our eyes or disagreeing. But when you're walking out into the world and every day you walk out into the world and the world is looking at you saying what, and they may not even be saying it loudly, but there's a subliminal message that how you were born, what you came into this world with is not good enough and will not get you what you need. And you will never sort of make it. You become, that's why we have these, all these Black girl magic things now, which is really positive because, you know, I can do a lot of things. I can work out. I can have muscles. I can learn how to swim, but I cannot change the texture of my hair. I cannot. There's nothing I can do. It is going to, I can perm it till the lie is coming out of my ears, but this is what it is. And so in order to, and for, you know, you either learn to accept that because you have love around you, or you try to fight it. And the more you fight it, the balder you're going to get.
Ken, thanks for, hold on. Let me just reintroduce everybody and also give out that phone number again. Ken, thanks for calling in to Radio Times. And you can call as well to join the conversation. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of comments here, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lori, let me put something to you, because I don't think we can talk about Black women and hair without talking about Michelle Obama. And of course, we could do a whole hour on her, but how do you see her hair as we're having this conversation?
Well, it's so funny. I was just asked to write an article about just that fact, kind of like as she's about to leave the office, you know, what has her hair meant for these last 8 years? And I think that, and actually I was asked the same question when she, you know, first came into the White House from I think it was a United Kingdom publication, but you know, there's this whole expectation for Michelle Obama has so much weight on her shoulders in terms of, you know, being the first African American first lady and what that meant and how that, what that represented. And I think that I would have loved to see the first lady with, you know, dreadlocks or some like an afro or something, just because it would have been so amazingly, you know, in your face, I'm Black and I'm here. But I also recognize that that's not the first lady's position and that she represents all of America and not just those of us who are, let's say, in a different headspace, no pun intended, with our hair. I think that Michelle Obama has made a very conscious decision to keep her hair non-controversial. I think that that's been a very strategic decision for her. I think that we as a country, as a culture, are not ready to have a first lady with natural hair, because as noted by all of the headlines and, you know, everything from the Olympic criticism to, you know, women, newscasters being fired, men being fired from their jobs as, you know, carriers or working at Six Flags or any other place, that we are clearly not in a place where we are okay with natural hairstyles. So like that, again, I think Michelle Obama made a strategic move to not, you know, all the other things that people were going to criticize her for, she wasn't going to give them that. And I think that, you know, her girls wore natural hairstyles at different times during their during the Obama presidency, and they were attacked. And so I can only imagine if it had been Michelle herself. So I think her hair, I think she has strategic hair. And I think that even that what she does with her hair is probably strategized. I'm sure there's like a planning meeting behind the Oval Office where they talk about what should we do with Michelle's O'Hare today. Are people ready for this or that? Because it would cause commotion. I think I've been on this show maybe three times now talking about.
I think
black
that's
hair.
Right. That's right.
So I can only imagine. I can only imagine how many more times I would have been on if Michelle Obama had decided to go natural. And but I have to make a point that Michelle Obama's hair might be natural. She may have the best pressing girl ever. She may not have chemicals in her hair. I don't know. But she keeps her hair straight, which is, I believe, a very strategic decision on her part to not make that yet another conversation and another controversy for her to deal with.
Let me get some callers in. We got Charlotte calling us from Lansdowne. Charlotte, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks
there.
For taking the call.
Sure.
I really do want to, this is, I think, the deeper issue beyond details of edges and kitchens and weaves is that for all of the time we have been on this soil, for several hundred years, we have been taught by the dominant culture to hate ourselves, to hate our features. And if you want to approach anything that resembles acceptability, social acceptability, you have to alter yourself or traumatize your features or your hair in some way so that they are acceptable to the dominant culture. And that pathology really has been manifested in black, in the community and in black women's behavior to the point that we even kind of enforce it among ourselves. So that we had someone like Wendy Williams, for example, trashing Viola Davis because Viola Davis chose to wear her hair in the way the creator made it at the Oscars. And she referred to that as unacceptable. So I grew up in the 60s. When we rejected that, I've been natural since 1968, starting with an afro. It is now locks. I reject the dominant culture's message that I am an unacceptable human being, that my creation is unacceptable. It is really difficult for us to counter that message because our girls see that message in so many ways, day after day after day. And the artificial hair business, hair care business among black women, is a multi-billion dollar business that we spend to toe the line with the dominant culture's message that we are unacceptable unless we do something to make ourselves look more Caucasian.
Well, Charlotte, I appreciate the call. And I can see both of my guests in front of me want to jump in. I'm going to give Elizabeth Wellington the first shot.
Part of why I'm a fashion columnist at The Enquirer, so I also do photo shoots and choose models. And I made a conscious decision not to choose African-American women models who don't have their own hair. So I use black models, and I use black models a lot. But I try really hard not to use black women models who have weave. Relaxers, fine. But weave, because I see these models and I see what happens. I see there's when you have weave, you lose a lot of hair. People are going through that.
It actually can hurt your
hair. It can hurt your hair, so you're not seeing it. So I really, really try. And I've had Sarita on my sets before doing women with natural hair on my sets because it's not Vogue, but it's a small way to send the message to anybody who looks at the paper to say, you know, it's okay to be who you are and you can still be beautiful as you are.
And I've done a Vogue.
Yeah, hold on, Laurie. Let me give Sarita a chance to jump in. Yeah,
I've done Vogue photo shoots, and they were with people with natural hair. So I feel like some of this we're going to have to dial back because we're giving a lot of power to a lot of negative energy. Mm-hmm. The reality, because as I said, I own a natural hair salon. Hundreds of women are coming in and out of my doors. And too often what I see is when I put a woman in front of, no matter what her hair texture is, in front of a really large mirror, they feel uncomfortable seeing themselves.
Really?
They find a way of picking at themselves. So we can talk about the dominant culture. I'm not giving that any energy because what I found is the problems that we have are usually with the people who are either to the left or the right of us. The scrutiny has come to me with people who look like me. So we're going to have to understand that regardless to what you want, this is what God gave you. So you're going to have to find some self-acceptance in yourself. You're going to have to find some beauty in you, and you're going to have to be able to look at a mirror and see who you are. You can alter whatever you want. And as Elizabeth said, you will be bald. So, and I'm so sorry.
So beware,
to, you have saying. To be aware of yourself, because I've worked corporate America and they pulled me in the office. And when I don't know, I was young. I was in my 20s. I said, you know, I want to start my locks. And the manager said, well, I don't think that would be a good idea. And keep in mind, I was the first person there and the last person that left to make sure I was present at my job. And let's be clear, the woman who managed me was brown. So I doubt if she went to upper management.
And she didn't want you to wear your hair a certain kind of way.
For her embarrassment, not mine. So I'm just challenging women, not just brown, not in all spectrums, to understand that no matter how blonde your hair is, no matter how kinky your hair is, no matter how dark your skin is, there has to get to a point where you're saying, this is who I am, and you're finding beauty in it. Because when we talk about our little girls, in which I'm raising one and a son, they're, as much as they're looking at the media, they are looking at you. So when you pick at you and you're willing to alter you, they're going to feel like something that is not normal. Altering is normal, and take on those same behaviors.
Lori, we're almost out of time. So, yeah, just make it quick if you can. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on Charlotte's comment. And, you know, from, you know, I'm bringing the history here, is that she's absolutely right that, you know, these feelings, I think everything Elizabeth said and everything Sarita said is absolutely right. I applaud both of those statements. But what Charlotte said is true, and that these feelings of self-hatred are not random. That during slavery, the slaveholders actually were very deliberate in enforcing this belief that there was something wrong with us, that there was something wrong with African features, because a slave that hated himself and thought of himself as inferior was much easier to control. So you consider 400 years of that type of negative brainwashing, and there was no large psychology counseling experiment post-slavery to undo all of that. Of course, there's going to be a latent sense of inferiority about these, our noses, our butts, our hair, all of that was different. We were told it made us inferior. I mean, we were systematically told that, and it was written down. It was put in science books. It was put in history books. So it takes a large effort to undo that. And I do think, though, that it does have to start with individuals. And I do have to just make a plug again that one thing that the Internet, the good thing
very
is
quickly.
Community building that I was saying, we can do that, and we can show alternative images. And that's what has to happen, I believe. And we can educate ourselves and understand that this was done, but it can be undone.
Elizabeth, I know you want to say something really quick. Looks like you did.
I did,
but I also am thinking of that bass player, Esmeralda Spalding, who's an incredible bass player, great big hair. I mean, is that the future, do you think, Elizabeth?
I think the thing is choice. I mean, you know, just because you're an African American woman does not mean you have to. I mean, just the same reason that women who are blonde, you know, you want to dye your hair blonde, dye your hair blonde. You just shouldn't have to think that if I don't do this, I won't be accepted by my own people or other people. It's about choice.
Exactly.
We are going to end on that note of choice. Elizabeth Wellington, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Sarita Scott, thank you for joining us
as
well. And Lori Tharps, thank you for joining us way up there in Canada somewhere.
Yes,
wherever you are.
I'm in Canada actually talking about black hair at a conference here. So
there you go. Go to thanks very much. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to carry on the conversation. We were hoping to talk about Leslie Jones in this hour, but maybe we'll save that for another time. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.